Hello, and thank you for tuning into the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your guest host, Jim Swift, sitting in for Charlie Sykes, who is traveling today. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm joined in studio by Jonathan Last, our executive editor, Andrew Egger, who is a senior writer, and Benjamin Parker, who's a senior editor. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
The gang's all here.
Staff cast.
Mega staff cast.
Right? And Egger and Parker are sharing a microphone.
Yes, more Bulwark
and so much
than even our own podcast studio knows what to do with.
If you want to donate to the Bulwark to get us a fourth microphone, Egger and Parker don't have to share one.
Would we need a whole new soundboard, too, if we got a fourth microphone? Can our soundboard handle another mic?
I'm not sure. We might need a new soundboard, too, but there is a link to do that.
Open up those pocketbooks, folks. We got a vision here.
And, you'll be rewarded handsomely with things we cannot mention. So, gentlemen, tax season is upon us. Does anyone have any fun tax stories?
Not from this year, and the reason why I'll tell you, Jim, is last year, and I've told you before, you got me out of a bit of a bind. April 12th came around, and it was like my first big like professional tax season filing taxes on my own, because I'd let my dad do that for me all through college because I'm a dissolute millennial. And April 12th rolled around. I was like, well, I guess I better TurboTax this thing. And quickly realized I was in way over my head, because I had to file like five different state tax returns that year. Called up my good friend Jim Swift, probably openly wept on the phone. I don't remember if that happened or not. It was a dark time in my life. And, you told me the good news about tax preparers, and I outsourced that, and I've never looked back.
How did this take you more than 15 minutes?
Well, Virginia, when you live in Virginia, the 760 PY, which is the partial year return,
right?
Huge pain in the ass.
But TurboTax just does all that for you.
Not for state returns. For states, the state, it's unbelievably. I don't know the last time you had to file multiple state tax returns, JBL,
every single year.
How many?
Always two, and often three or more.
Okay. Well, look, you're a smarter man than I. You're a more accomplished man than I. Something I was.
I don't know that either of those things are true. I mean, I just have never had TurboTax has never let me down.
I love the experience where TurboTax tried to make me register as a Pennsylvania small business in order to do my taxes there.
Really?
Yeah, that was a whole mess.
That's crazy. Is this when you were in college, like living up in Philly, or?
Right, this is when I was living in Philadelphia, and because of summer jobs and things, I had to do federal taxes, but also D.C., Virginia, and Pennsylvania.
Interesting.
And the Pennsylvania one just really, I think at one point it tried to tell me I was a mining company.
It's like
there's a lot of those in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Is TurboTax still the gold standard online? I mean, I just use
TurboTax,
it every year because
H&R Block, but Congress apparently is set to potentially ban the IRS. Now, there's a legitimate, in my view, question about whether or not we should be having the government doing your taxes for you, right? Like in some countries, you just get like a little bill because they collect all of your taxes for the most part if you're a salaried employee, and they say, is this right to you? Sign on this. And we'll do this. But in America, of course, things are a little bit more complicated. People live in states and do business in multiple states. And, you know, while the government gets all this information, they don't always get, you know, especially in the journalism industry when you're doing freelance work or other sorts of things, they don't always get all of that. So it's a little complicated. But Congress is potentially set to ban the Treasury and the IRS from offering free tax filing stuff for the federal government. On the Bulwark podcast here on our roundtable, what say you, gentlemen? Is this a right thing or wrong thing for Congress to do?
You tell me, boys.
Well, the only experience I have with the IRS, and I'm not even super familiar with this story. Are you saying they're specifically saying that federal employees won't be able to make use of the IRS?
No. That Congress is potentially set to ban, my understanding, from having the Treasury Department offer basically like a free version of H&R Block,
right,
to taxpayers,
to anybody. Okay, yeah, because
I mean, just the form.
There's like a website where you can go on. It's like a very simplified version of TurboTax for your online, for your federal returns.
No,
I will say that in my aforementioned Dark Night of the Soul last April, I very briefly looked into this service, and I'm not entirely sure that it's particularly useful. Obviously, it's the federal government providing a service that, you know, you would have to pay a lot of money for. So it's supposed to be for people, you know, who have a hard time, you know, affording a tax preparer or things like that. It's a good idea. I don't know how actually functionally serviceable the thing is. that's my preliminary take on this.
Sure. And the economy is changing too, right? I mean, the gig economy and the growth of Lyft drivers and Uber drivers and DoorDash and Instacart and
TaskRabbit
and all these sorts of things. I mean, everyone's a contractor. Everything's a gig. And, you know, taxes are going to be a little bit more complicated.
Right.
So,
but I will say, I mean, were you suggesting as we talked before the podcast started that this is sort of a, perhaps an issue of sort of corrupt lobbying on behalf of organizations like H&R Block or TurboTax?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think there is, from a conservative standpoint, is it the job of the government to do this? I mean, to what degree, right? Do we dedicate this to? I mean, because there's something called the tax gap. There's a theoretical difference. I mean, it's a real difference, but the amount varies. There's a difference between what the government expects it should be collecting and what it actually does.
Right.
And then they look at, you know, what the return on investment is. And whenever the IRS budget comes up, you know, Republicans say we're going to cut enforcement. The Democrats say, well, we're going to get the tax gap. And, you know, would making this easier for folks without having to make them go to Tung Tu CPA out in Falls Church.
Shout out to Tung Tu CPA.
Yes.
If any of you are in Falls Church, Virginia.
This is perfectly within the whole tradition of tax law, where we have the idea that you can deduct your CPA's fee is amazing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's the most pure bit of like tax code pork ever, that the tax preparers convince the government to let people write off their fees. That's nuts. Like, I just don't understand why that exists. It strikes me as crazy. And so
I thought tax reform was going to fix all of this.
That's the amazing thing is we just passed this Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which as was originally conceived of as predominantly reforming the system. Obviously, Donald Trump's preferred selling point was that it cut corporate taxes. He didn't want to sell it as tax reform. He says it at every rally. I made sure we talked about the cuts, but it's fair to say that, I mean, I think a lot of people, and as you say, part of it's the gig economy, part of it's just the fact that people's tax situations are growing more complicated. But if the goal was to actually just take a gigantic bite out of tax complication, I mean, surely, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I don't know what your people's experience of this has been. I have not found taxes to have grown substantially less complicated in this particular tax year.
You know,
I agree with that. And also, I think this idea of whether or not the federal government should give you a free service to figure out how much that you owe or how much they owe you back in taxes,
right,
becomes sort of, I think it goes hand in hand with the idea that we are loaning our money to the federal government for free every year. And if the federal government is going to do withholding, it makes sense that they tell you, you know, how much they've collected versus how much they think they should have.
Right.
But it'd be a much better system if they didn't withhold at all and you had to, you know, actually feel the bite of giving a chunk of your earnings to the government every year. And then you would have to figure it out. And that'd be part of the bite. That's like
that would require, you know, personal responsibility. Someone I used to work with on the Hill when I worked for members of the Tax Writing Committee shared this video with Ivanka Trump, who, you know, despite her apparent successes as a businesswoman, you know, was incorrectly saying, oh, you're going to be able to do your taxes on a postcard next year.
Remember that? That was the Steve Forbes plan.
Yes.
And everybody said that for months and months.
It was never true. And plus, I mean, do you really want postal workers having access to your social security number? I mean, it's an inherently stupid idea. Republicans have long pushed.
Actually, that you would, like, you know,
I think
fill
it was
out.
Like,
right. So people don't remember then, like, the 96 debates. Like, Steve Forbes was up there on the debate stage holding a postcard. You're going to be able to do your taxes and send them in right here on this thing, this postcard.
I'd still be in, like, a security envelope.
Well, then it's not a postcard, right?
Right, yeah.
But the funny thing was, Ivanka was recording this video outside of the Rose Garden that one of my friends and her husband, you know, I know from the Hill, were sharing because he was involved in writing the Tax and Job Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Was Ivanka was like, don't forget, you know, to take that double child deduction. And I just thought, like, how tone deaf is this? If you have a child, you're going to be like, you know, oh, shit, do I really check that box to get the child deduction? Or, I mean, it's just no wonder people hate it. Well, to our listeners, enjoy tax season.
Have you guys done yours yet?
Yeah, I got an email from the IRS saying we're actually getting back more than double what we had gotten from our, you know, H&R Block or whatever we used. And so my dad, I went to him, a tax attorney. I'm like, this seems wrong. And he goes, well, it's possible that in previous tax years, all this other things, he was like, just don't spend the money and just wait because they might send you an explanation as to why you're right. getting this.
Interesting.
Come try to claw it back from you. Or?
Absolutely. And I've dealt with the IRS a number of times over the years. Okay. So taxes, enjoy those. Now we're going to switch to something sort of a little potpourri since it is a staff cast. Trending on Twitter right now is a surreal experience that you had IRL, as the kids say, in real life with a celebrity.
Oh, you didn't say IRL. I didn't prepare one IRL. I prepared a Twitter experience.
Okay, that worked. That's
Twitter,
fine,
Twitter
too.
Twitter is real life for DC journalists.
Sure.
I mean, like that's...
So, Ben, so tell us your Twitter TRL, Twitter real life.
My Twitter real life experience was that... someone took a screenshot of a piece I had written back in March or February. I can't remember. Took a screenshot of a piece I had written and tweeted it out. And I immediately got like 100 new followers because that person happened to be, I can't remember his name. I was just looking for it. One of the producers of The Office. And he had like tagged me in his tweet. Huh. And so if you're listening,
American
we
royalty.
Do need another microphone. Just saying.
JBL.
My, I have so many because I used to go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and hang out with Matt Labash.
Yeah.
And when you're with Matt Labash, good things happen. So the most surreal experience I've ever had was the year that I snuck into the Bloomberg after party, as Fred Barnes. And the entire night was nothing but surreal experiences. So I showed up to the party. Half in the bag. Rich Eisen is in line behind me. I get in by telling the nice lady with the clipboard that I'm Fred Barnes. He cannot get in as Rich Eisen. And I try to get in. I turn, you know, I'm halfway in the door and I turn around. And I said, you know, you've got to let him in. Don't you know who he is? That's Rich Eisen. And she's like, I don't care who he is. He's not on the list. And I looked at Rich. And I was like, I'm sorry, bro. And so I walk in. As I'm walking in, Harrison Ford is walking out. And I sort of like drunk stagger over to him. And I'm like, Jonathan Lass from the Weekly Standard. Love your work. You changed my life as Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And he's like, oh, thank you. You know, and... Anyway, so the rest of the night is, and I don't drink very much at all ever. Even when I was a kid, I didn't drink very much. And so I had way too much to drink. And the entire rest of the night for me is like in a Guy Ritchie movie where they move to the part where you just get a series of slides, right? You know, where you get stills. And so I have a still where I'm like doing shots with Drew Carey, another still where it's me, Drew Carey, and Ariana Huffington. There's another still where I'm like up at the bar having gummy worms with Shannon Doherty. And the whole night was essentially like that, culminating with my not yet wife, but my girlfriend at the time coming to pick me up and her, who's stone cold sober. She didn't do any of this, but she like drove into DC in the middle of the night. And she almost ran over Ralph Nader.
So
Ralph Nader was stumbling across Connecticut Avenue while we were coming to a stop. And it was literally like his hands were on the hood of our car. And
is she unsafe at any speed?
No, I think Nader may have been a little bit sloshed too.
I almost hit Bernie Sanders once when he was running for president. He had a campaign office not far from the Heritage Foundation where my wife works, and he and an aide were just walked out from behind a van, and I had hit the little translate button on my phone to dictate something, and I look up and I jam on the brakes, and you know, Weekly Standard staffer, you know, like
socialist presidential candidate.
Yeah. But that's not the funniest. That's not the I can imagine, you know, you and Ariana Huffington, oh darling, we have to have another shot, you know.
Yeah. I used to be friends with her from back in the day. This is what was so funny about it. In fact I once had drinks with Ariana Huffington in her house, and that is when I met Andrew Breitbart. This
right.
is back when Breitbart was still working for her, and she was conservative, and the whole thing, showing up at Ariana's Brentwood house to like have drinks with her as a 23-year-old,
pretty cool,
was super cool and super interesting, and she was lovely and very, very sweet and gracious. But what is your, or should we save you for last? Should
okay, I'll go last.
Come on. I mean, like, come on, surely eggs. That should have been the last story. I mean, I'm supposed to follow, you know, shots with.
I'm sure you did something
okay.
cool.
Okay,
once.
I can do a palate cleanser if you don't want to follow that thunder.
Mine is just on Twitter as well. And my story is just that anytime you tweet.
Oh, a famous person
who,
retweeted
anytime
you.
Anytime you tweet at the guy
cool.
who writes Dilbert, he will clap back. And that's the whole story. Just fun fact.
He doesn't follow his own advice
at
of not elevating the, you know. So the relative nobodies.
If you told the 8-year-old version of me that I would be in regular conversation with the Dilbert guy, I probably, and you know, once I entered adult society, I would probably think that was pretty cool.
Was he like your Bill Watterson?
I liked Bill Watterson better, but I just read a ton of the, you know, like those like collections of like newspaper comics you get at the library or whatever. Yeah. I was really into those as a dorky child.
Dilbert's a fine comic. I think
your favorite genre of book is coffee table book. Clearly, like
right, yeah.
Berkeley
that
briefed.
Continues to this day. Yeah.
Brief detour.
Yeah.
Favorite newspaper comic strip of all time. Go.
Peanuts.
Go.
Garfield.
Calvin
what?
And
Garfield.
Hobbes.
What?
I've never read a newspaper comic.
Garfield
it was the
sucks.
One I thought
it's
of.
It's so unfunny. Okay, why would you go? Okay.
You might as well have said
sorry,
Ziggy.
Sorry.
Which one's is that the is that like an animal?
It's the only one worse than Garfield. I can't believe that. All right, Jim, go.
Does the Far Side
Calvin
count?
And Hobbes.
Does the Far Side count?
Yeah.
The Far Side. Okay. Oh, by a long shot. You
Calvin and Hobbes. Being a fan of Calvin and Hobbes is like being a Yankees fan of cartoons in a way. But Bill Watterson, a DC native, spent his formative years in Cleveland, and he drew the cartoon in a idyllic suburb called Chagrin Falls, which is not where I grew up, Shaker Heights. But my parents retreated due to tax purposes to Chagrin Falls, and that's where he spent most of his life. And then when he got really famous, people started stalking him there. He used to like sign. Oh. There's a little bookstore in the main town. And he used to sign the collections, and then people started hawking them on eBay because he was very anti-commercial.
Famously like reclusive, right?
Very reclusive.
He wrote himself into sort of his own worst nightmare by just becoming successful.
Yeah, so then people tried finding him, and I think now he like lives in downtown Cleveland, which is like now the... Now what
Cleveland.
You do, you go downtown to be reclusive as opposed to living in the suburb where you could be found. So, but yeah, Calvin and Hobbes.
You might even meet this guy.
That's a great video.
Wait, JVL, what was yours?
It depends on the time of day, whether it is the Far Side or Bloom County or Calvin and Hobbes. I probably more Far Side Bloom County than Calvin and Hobbes.
Calvin and Hobbes was my first favorite cartoon as a child.
Yeah.
I think. It's delightful.
You know, because we at least got print. Andy Ferguson, our former colleague, has his first piece in The Atlantic today about how print will never die and why it's awesome. You should all read it. It'll be in the newsletter today.
So your celebrities.
I was debating between two stories. One was when Barack Obama was a presidential candidate. He came off the Senate floor during a Votorama during the budget time, which is something they don't do anymore. And he literally just like went headfirst right into me. And like, and I'm kind of a stocky guy. So like, he basically just ran into me and he was like, "Sorry, brother." And it just hits me and just walks on out. But you know, no Secret Service in the Senate chamber. But that wasn't as funny as the 2008 Republican convention. I was driving around VIPs. It was like Bud Day, Senator Richard Burr, Buddy Raymer. Bud Day was like a war buddy of McCain. He's a hero. And Buddy Raymer, former Louisiana governor. And I'm taking them around to these little breakfasts where they talk to the convention delegates and the press is there. And the idea is, you know, John McCain's a hero. Republicans are great. You know, listen to these stories. And I get my email on the BlackBerry they gave me. And bzz, 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 it's like, here's the guidance. Bristol Palin's pregnant. So I got to tell like John McCain's some of his buddies like, "Hey, guess what? The vice presidential pick that John McCain has, you know, her teenage daughter has a love child with like the guy from Mystery Alaska, you know, hockey movie reference there." And, you know, Burr's in the backseat of the SUV dipping, and that guy doesn't even spit. He swallows. He's such a pro. He swallows his chew.
Good Lord.
Old school.
And so I'm like, you know, right before I'm about to start reading the talking points about how people can spin this in a positive light, because you know
pro-life values.
Burr,
life all the time.
Burr pauses and goes, "Shit, son, I could have told you that." Have you seen her? And I was just like,
news on the Bulwark podcast.
Oh, yeah, man. No, I love Richard Burr for that. So that's my celebrity story.
That is awesome.
Okay, so yesterday, Candace Owens from Turning Point USA was testifying with other folks before the House Judiciary Committee to discuss
Only the best.
Only the best. Oh, it was the rise of white nationalism.
Yeah, that, I mean, It was ostensibly a forum about white nationalism. It was also sort of touching on tech issues.
Hate crimes.
Yeah. Some representatives from big tech companies were there because obviously one of the big issues that people think about when they think about sort of the rise of sort of antisocial fringy ideologies is
right.
how they percolate and fester on social media. So, representatives from Google and Facebook were there to sort of answer for how they're planning to, stop these things from happening. And Candace Owens obviously there as well.
Yeah. Why do you think she was invited?
Are you looking at me? I don't know. I don't know how people
they wanted
like that
to
get
learn,
to come to these
Jim.
Things. Yeah,
they're there to listen.
To get up in front of the house and say that it's not so much a problem if Candace Owens wants to talk about white supremacy as long as it's in one country. It only becomes a problem when it goes into
when
multiple
it goes global.
Countries.
Yeah,
no, okay,
right?
Yeah, that's a deep cut, right? Yeah.
Well, in that sort of if we're going back to JVL sort of like frames of everything, that was the frame from yesterday, which Congressman Ted Lieu from California. Got out his iPhone and played Candace Owens' kind of idiotic comments about Hitler going global. And, then like a couple, minutes later, she just went in, body bagged him. And it was, it was like the turning point USA-ification of the House of Representatives and kind of making a mockery of
what do you mean by body bagged him? What does that even mean?
That's what someone responded to me. Because I said yesterday on Twitter, please let me know which Republican invited her so I can never take them seriously ever again. And someone was just like, she body bagged those bozos on the hill.
That's sort of just the logical
owning the lips.
Yeah, it's the logical outgrowth of sort of the progression that we see for years now, which is that the proceedings like this, conversations even like presumably dull and dusty ones like congressional hearings, sort of form themselves, mold themselves to the form of the kind of media that is used to distribute them. So
in the current body politics.
Yeah. So it's a thing. Yeah. It's a thing that like Luddites have sort of groaned about for a long time that, C-SPAN in congressional hearings has been bad for the quality of discourse because, the sort of soundbite forward nature of of TV when TV was the prevailing technology makes people grandstand, makes people, try to speak for these, 15-second clips on cable news. The next logical step of that is the YouTubeification of these hearings, where it's not that people are just going to get 15-second attention spans. It's going to get you're going to get 15-minute long YouTube videos that are Candace Owens in front of the Hill. She says her piece, and then you cut to Candace Owens, talking all about how she owned Ted Lieu, and it's kind of funny because that's the thing that they were all there to discuss, but they were actually sort of participating in sort of the grosser forms of that as they were there in the year.
I thought
the structure of the Republic is very meta.
Yeah, I thought it was sort of instructive that the Judiciary Committee's YouTube feed had to shut down the comments because on live stream videos, there's a live comment because they were too racist.
And we've known about this for a long time, that sort of the internet is a cesspool that we all would rather not be dunked in all the time. And we're all sort of dunking ourselves in it increasingly. And it's bad for the country. And that's just sort of the way that it is. We don't seem to think that there's any way to sort of decelerate this thing. But
did she actually own the libs? This is a thing I would have thought was impossible before we saw Michael Cohen testify before Congress.
Yeah.
But when Cohen owned everybody when he was testifying for the House Judiciary Committee, I just thought these people are all such idiots, both right and left, and so dumb.
I think it was
Candace Owen could conceivably own them.
Could have been a Rorschach test.
Then. Yeah.
Everyone saw what they wanted. What I saw was the death of serious Republicans, in on the Hill.
Well, and the thing that Candace did that people were either dunking on her for or saying she was a brave teller of truths for was she just got up and she was like, black Americans are leaving the Democratic Party because we're waking up to the fact that the Southern strategy never happened. And she just said that. And tons of mooks online are just like, Candace, tell your truth. And it's craziness. But I think that the one thing that the Democrats were able to avoid with Candace, that they didn't really avoid with Michael Cohen, is that they sort of just treated her like a joke. I mean, fact that Lieu just sort of held up his phone and played that Hitler quote of Candace's, he was essentially saying, you're not a serious person. We're not going to engage with you like a serious person. And that was the downfall of the Democrats, when they were talking to Michael Cohen, is that they very transparently felt like they needed something
just
out of
to
him.
Stoop to the level.
Right. And so they allowed him to sort of, posture and grandstand and fluff himself up because they were in their minds he was there to fluff himself up, but also to undermine Trump and testify about Trump's criminal behavior. So they sort of allowed the first to happen and even encouraged the first so that they could get to the second, and that was what kind of made them look silly for Cohen.
If I was counsel to the chairman, I would have said, don't let anyone on the majority ask her a single question. Just pretend she's not even there, and then let the Republicans, you know, ask her about Blexit and all these other sorts of things. I mean, you risk losing a PR game with people who specialize in trolling and getting people to reduce themselves to their level just by engaging. But then, of course, the narrative would have been like, Congress doesn't even give a, you know, like Dems don't even care what Candace Owens have to, you know, I mean, it's kind of a lose-lose, and maybe that's why Republicans invited her. Do you guys have any weekend plans, you know, Friday, Saturday? Is anything happening on Friday, JBL? Do we know of anything big happening on Friday?
This feels like a trick question.
We don't know of anything big.
Why don't you tell us what's happening?
There's, you know, many big multi-hundred documents, documents.
The redacted report. You know, we were talking about this yesterday at the office. When we think it would drop, and I think like 5 p.m. Friday on tax weekend.
Why do they do?
Congress the time is to do it with? And, right?
Can someone tell me what the point of it is? Is it? Is there any good reason for it other than to make poor schmucks like us have to, like, you know, stay up half the night on a Friday night schlepping through this report? I mean,
it's
like, not that that's a gigantic...
Say. No, but it's to bury it. Yeah. I mean, this is a classic Washington, a time-honored Washington tradition.
Friday afternoon news dump.
It's not like this is going to work. I mean, like, it's not like the Mueller report is not going to... I mean, I'm sure it often works. I'm sure there's a reason for the strategy.
Otherwise, they wouldn't keep doing it.
For, like, B to C tier stories. But this is, like, the big story of the year,
but
right?
It still lessens the amplitude of it, though. I mean, so look, a story like this is going to go to 11... But if you just sort of, I mean, even looking at from like the way web traffic works, a story like this that drops on Friday afternoon will go to 11 on Friday night and throughout the weekend. But the base levels are already so low there that it's just different than if it happens Tuesday afternoon.
Right. Like the peak is the Sunday shows and then
it really is just a different, I mean, the whole cycle is shorter, right? Because you drop it on a Monday, you have an entire week's worth of it. Like it literally goes 4 or 5 days. This way you do it on a Friday. Basically by Monday, it is old news. You have fewer people checked in anyway. You don't have people. It really does cut everything down, even on a story like this. It doesn't make the story disappear. It doesn't make it invisible, but it tamps down the amplitude of it all.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's
yeah.
like leaning into a punch in a way. Like you can choose when to do it, and you know, Barr is going to make it as good as possible for Trump.
So I guess we should argue about that. Maybe we're gonna do that.
Bill Barr. So, Andrew, why do you love Bill Barr
much? Everybody around here. So, I've written a number of
pieces.
Did
Bill Barr ever take a bullet for you, Andrew Egger?
I've written a number of pieces for The Bulwark, pushing back on this narrative that a lot of people have that Barr is essentially a Trump partisan. He's in the bag. He's deliberately slow rolling the report. He's deliberately softening the report for Trump. I think all these things are possible. I mean,
Bill Barr the greatest living American.
I didn't know.
Why is that,
well,
Andrew?
Okay. Well, the reason I believe that Bill. No. Yeah. I mean, look, it's healthy to distrust your government officials. It's healthy to, you know, want to verify the things that they're doing. At no point in this whole process of Barr's confirmation to now have I seen him do anything that amounts to confirming the notion that he's sort of in the bag for Trump. And I think that, you know, it's not a matter of trusting him. It's just sort of a matter of looking at the incentive structures, where it's like, to what degree does Barr himself stand to gain or stand to lose from just essentially becoming a Trump shill? And the counter argument is there's a lot of people who have become Trump shills, even though it seems like it's to their detriment for them to do so, you know, just in Congress or in the administration or things like that. But the rejoinder to that is that essentially these are people who wouldn't agree with you that it's to their own permanent career detriment to shill for Trump. They think that they stand to, raise their own profile, or they think that they stand to get in with Trump's inner circle. They think this is just what the Republican Party is now, and, you know, this is how I can maximize my own personal power. But Barr's a guy like Mueller who's coming in sort of from the outside of things. All of the reasons why Mueller was sort of universally praised as like a good choice for the special counsel when he was first appointed back in the day in a bipartisan fashion was for a lot of the same reasons that would recommend Barr, is that he's just sort of like a longtime sort of straight shooting guy who's coming in from the outside, doesn't necessarily have a lot riding on the line in a partisan fashion. And I have not yet seen anything from Barr with his conduct in the hearings or anything to challenge that preconception. Now, that said, and I know I'm rambling on here, so I'll try to be quick. The one thing that I do think is a serious concern about Barr is, yeah, I mean, like there's a reason Trump picked him, and that reason is because he has a relatively expansive view of what the White House's powers are in a lot of different areas. He does seem to skew conservative in his approach to politics, which isn't necessarily disqualifying. I mean, like you're allowed to be a politics and work at the Justice Department. You're allowed to be a conservative and work at the Justice Department. You're allowed to be a liberal and work at the Justice Department. But certainly, you know, I mean, in his testimony just today, I mean, he's testifying right now as we're recording this, and so we're not completely up to date, but he did say that he thinks that the Obama administration might have incorrect spied on the Trump campaign, mm-hmm. When they opened this counterintelligence investigation, which is, they did open that investigation. The language of spying tends to be something that is, you know, the right's been throwing around, but is certainly not accepted bipartisanly. But he did say, you know, they surveilled them. We don't know whether the surveillance was justified. It very well could have been justified. And that's, so he's thinking of opening up an investigation into that. All of that to say, let's just wait and see on Barr. Let's just wait and see the report. Can we just wait and see? Can we not necessarily shoot the messenger until we have a good reason to do so? And that's all I have to say.
I think that you may be slightly discounting the judicial philosophical incentives. Yeah, I mean, which you acknowledge, not zero, but I mean, there is a branch of conservative legal thought which really does view the power of the executive as being an important thing to preserve and expand it at almost all costs. This is a bone of some contention in conservative legal. I would say the Federalist Society is not united in this view, right? I mean, there are guys like, I think John Yoo is one of them, right? Who's a big, you know, expansive executive authority guy. Barr is one of them. It could entirely be that that's where his motives lie on this, and that those motives are totally independent of Trump or Mueller or anything else. That would not surprise me.
Yeah,
and those guys sometimes will deal from the side of the deck, at least, if not the bottom of the deck, in pursuit of what they view as their maxims, right?
That's a slightly different issue, though. And they intersect at some point, but the Venn diagram is not a circle in the issues of what the powers of the presidency are and how they should be interpreted under Article 2 and what the president can get away with or how much information should be, you know, kept internal to the Justice Department to protect his reputation. It's entirely possible that the president has expansive power, but the Justice Department at the same time is perfectly capable of embarrassing him and shouldn't go out of its way to avoid that.
Right. So JBL, I'm 100% sympathetic to that line of argument that you're bringing up. The thing that I'm pushing back against is, and I don't know to what degree people are concerned about that versus the sort of more
probably zero, well, frankly. I think most
of the reactionary
people who do,
sort of like resistancy,
people, right,
resistancy take is just like Barr's bought and paid for. Trump
right,
has something
correct.
On Barr. Barr's a bad actor. And I guess that could be the case. It just doesn't. There's circumstantial evidence. I mean, the letter that he wrote to the Justice Department to suggest that, you know, Mueller might need to back off a particular line of his obstruction of justice inquiry last summer. I mean, yeah, there are data points that would allow a person who is, you know, operating with a hermeneutic of suspicion to suspect Barr of foul play. And so, I mean, okay, that's fine. Barr should be trying to go out of his way to dilute or work against that narrative, perhaps, which you could argue he's not doing maybe that's because he's just sort of a crotchety guy. That was the impression that I got during his confirmation hearings, which actually was part of what made me sort of resistant to this whole take, is like he didn't really seem like he cared all that much if they confirmed him or not. He's like, look, the president wants to make me attorney general. I feel like I do a good job as attorney general, but I'm not going to like sit here and like tell you guys the things that you want to hear me say in order to make it more likely for me to be attorney general. The thing he kept saying was, I don't need the title, which I kind of respected. I mean, it was like, all right, that's kind of cool. I mean,
Is that when you got red pilled for,
yeah, exactly.
For bar?
Red pilled for what would that even be? You know, like being red pilled, but for just sort of like boring, sort of process oriented career justice.
Yeah, he looks like Fred Barnes. Right, you know, right. He's got the glasses, the hair. I mean, it's friendly Fred. It's right. Friendly Bill.
Right. Beige pilled.
Now I forget which one of the guys on Mount Rushmore did you want to replace with Bill Barr? was it Washington?
It would be. Wait, who are the four? It's Washington, Lincoln, Roosevelt. I thought it was Roosevelt. Roosevelt was the one I was going to say. Get rid of Roosevelt. What's he doing up there?
Yeah. Okay. It's tough but fair.
Last topic. Devin Nunes is seemingly not enjoying his time as a member of the House minority and has filed two lawsuits. The most recent one was against McClatchy Newspapers for a story that was at the Fresno Bee ran kind of about, what was it, prostitutes, fundraising, a winery he's an owner of. Have you guys paid attention to the lawsuits he's been filing at all?
I have tried not to do a deep dive on any of these things. I mean, they're frivolous, right?
That's two nine-figure lawsuits.
I looked up the lawyer. His name is Steven.
Devin Nunes is really into Twitter, isn't he?
yeah.
This guy needs to come on my sort of Twitter sabbatical. Just walk away from it.
Yes.
He will.
Twigs it
is real. Yeah. My God.
So I looked up the lawyer, Steven Biss, and as Twitter, you know, journalists do when they snark, start pouring through the text of these lawsuits. And Stephen Biss uses an Earthlink email, not to name and shame any of our former colleagues, but, you know, Earthlink emails are like a sign that you really don't get technology, right? That or you're like ironic.
AOL Online or something.
Yeah. Or GeoCities. I mean, unless you're a hipster who's keeping it ironically, it's usually a sign like you're not with the times. So this guy, Stephen Biss, if you search his email, which is easily findable, I'm not going to put it here on the podcast, lest any of you email him and narc on us, but you can find all these lawsuits that he's part of, and you just start adding up all of the figures, and it's like well over almost $2 billion worth of these things that he's filed because Virginia has a long arm statute. But it's so interesting to read the lawsuit written by his lawyer. And if you go and look at some of these other things, this guy's like a personal injury and does all these cases. Like these things could all be fun short stories if they didn't involve the lives of real people, which, you know, right. In a case makes it sad. But in one instance, when you do an advanced search on Twitter and you search for terms, it bolds the terms, just like when you search for something in a Word document. And the lawyer is unaware that this and is now claiming that the reporters are emphasizing certain things. And
look, they bolded it in their tweet.
Which you can't do. And so, you know, people are doing this to mock it. And, you know, you have to pay for, you know, Law 360 and all these other sorts of things. But if this guy had a scorecard in successes in these big things, it does not appear that if I were, the honorable gentleman from California, I would be too confident in my legal future here with these lawsuits.
Here is a question I have for you guys. These lawsuits do not make it appear as though Devin Nunes is an especially serious person. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
Yes.
They make him look kind of a little bit like an ambulance chaser, kind of a little bit maybe like a crank, maybe not somebody whose judgment is so good. Are these fair characterizations, would we say?
Where are you going with this, counselor?
Up until 3 months ago, he held a job for 4 years that was probably one of the two or three dozen most important jobs in all of America. He was the chairman of the House Select Committee of Intelligence. This is a really, really important job that we think should basically only go to like really responsible people who are going to take care of the nation's best interests, right? And so was he this same guy that whole time? Or did something happen that changed him, and so he's just become radicalized, or become he's
red pill?
He's all YOLO'd up, or something, or is he still the same serious guy that he was when he was the House chairman?
Well, you'd have to think that a lot of the people in conservative media who have taken sort of the FISA gate scandal that Nunes made his signature issue for years while he was on the intelligence committee have to be unhappy with the fact that he's now just sort of coming out swinging at all, in all of these sort of unserious directions. I mean, like, Nunes was the face, the public face of the supposed Republican investigations into supposed malfeasance at the Justice Department when it came to actually getting this show on the road with the investigation that would later become the Mueller probe. And the sort of crowning document for this, which came out just over a year ago, was sort of the Nunes memo, where he essentially wrote about sort of how the Justice Department had gone about getting the warrant to surveil Carter Page, who was a former Trump staffer, about potential connections, about his potentially being compromised as a Russian spy. But yeah, I mean, like, so certainly this does no favors to Nunes's credibility. Not that, you know, not that that document was very useful even at the time. I mean, yeah. I have some sympathies to sort of like the FISAgate narrative. I mean, my personal opinion is, like, it's, as we were talking about this a little earlier on the Slack, sort of as a civil libertarian, it's not surprising to me that the Justice Department, like, can just go out and, like, sort of get warrants to surveil people that they think are foreign agents, and that's easier than it ought to be. But the problem for Nunes is that he has consistently supported, along with most of the GOP, the expansion of these sort of surveillance programs. And right. So what he had to do was he had to try to find a way to pretend that this was not just sort of business as usual for the Justice Department. This was like some extra legal bad behavior by justice, and that they had actually tricked the FISA court into thinking that they had a case to surveil Page when they really did not. That despite the fact that these FISA courts are functionally, they're secret courts, they're functionally rubber stamps for these surveillance warrants, they're hardly ever overturned. And so there was no need for the Justice Department, even if they were sort of politically motivated or whatever, to try to unlawfully trick a FISA court into letting them spy on this guy.
Okay. I take a different interpretation of the FISA courts. I mean, the fact that they rarely overturn warrants could just, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth. So I've, you know, been told, before they officially submit the warrant, you know, you have to establish probable cause. You can, you know, sort of informally ask whether or not you have enough before you submit the warrant. So when the warrant is finally formally submitted, you already know whether or not you have probable cause. And also, it's not like they just got the one warrant and then spied for years. It's, you know, they got five in a row. Each one, they had to show probable cause to get it renewed. I think the idea actually is that they sort of tricked the FISA court doesn't do enough justice to the FISA court and how serious that that process is.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to this extra expanded mega podcast. Charlie Sykes will be returning tomorrow.